Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're less than 3 weeks away from the recall election, and we're getting a first glimpse at who is voting. Even though we don't know who people are voting for, we'll get those results on election night, September 14th, there is a breakdown of political party, demographics, and where they live in the state. Paul Mitchell is with the bipartisan data firm Political Data, Inc., which tracks the ballots coming in. And he joins us with what the preliminary findings tell us. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Sean Hubler, California correspondent for The New York Times. Sean recently tapped into voters and felt the weight that mixed feelings among voters can have on the election. That is, if they're even aware or care that one is happening. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
Well, Paul, let's start with you. I mean, this is a very preliminary glimpse at who is voting already. Of the record 22 plus million ballots mailed out, roughly 1 million have been returned. So we're talking a very small slice of 5%. But with that caveat, what are you learning?
Well, we're learning more every day. And in fact, as of this morning, that number has jumped. We're right now at around 2.4 million ballots that have been returned already. We've gone over the 10% mark. We're right at around 11% of ballots being returned. And I think what we're learning is that there was this shift in voting patterns in 2020, where for decades past, it was always Republicans who voted early. We used to joke they were the ones that knew where their stamps were. But they were, you know, homeowners. They were more, you know, comfortable voting by mail. They're more traditionally early vote by mail voters. And Democrats generally voted closer to election day at the polls. And we always saw this kind of time function in our elections that favored Republicans early and Democrats late. We even saw that in 2018, where all those close races kind of flipped towards Democrats in the late counted ballots. In 2020, the Republicans kind of made this unilateral decision of, we don't trust vote by mail. Vote by mail is a scam or a fraud or not safe. And so they encouraged their voters to vote late. And Democrats kind of caught onto their own conspiracy theories and were like, well, DeJoy's not going to deliver the ballots, or they had these viral videos of people taking post office, you know, post boxes off of streets. And so Democrats were like, well, we need to vote super, super early. And that has, I think, continued. We see this enormous surge from Democrats voting early this cycle. And Republicans, we would expect, are going to be voting later. But that 2.4 million ballots with 19 days of voting left is really a record pace, kind of presidential looking numbers. But I just want to caution that it's early, and we still have a lot more voting to go. And if the recall were, say, to be successful, the Newsom campaign couldn't get much consolation from the fact that, you know, our voters voted earlier.
Yeah.
All the votes count the same.
Right. Anything about the initial data that surprises you, just given, you know, just kind of the volume that we've already gotten in so far?
Yeah, one of the things that's surprising is that we know historically, like I said, it's the homeowners, it's the more, you know, suburban voters oftentimes that would vote early. And generally that meant that they'd be more Republican. So now we have an electorate where Democrats are really overrepresented in the early votes, kind of 2-to-1 advantage for Democrats in these early votes. But still, young people and minorities are not part of that huge groundswell. It seems as though it's more the white, more affluent progressives that are casting their ballots early. To give a frame of reference here, among age groups, they're all about the same. 65 plus voters, about 5 million. There's about 6 million 18 to 34 year olds. The 65 plus, 1 in 5 of them have already cast their ballot. They're at 20% turnout already. Among the 18 to 34 year olds, only 1 in 20 has returned a ballot. They're only at 5% turnout so far. So that age breakdown being so striking in an electorate where we're seeing other numbers that suggest, you know, a expanded electorate is really surprising.
You know, I understand the governor and, you know, supporters strongly labeled this a Republican recall. But from your analysis, I mean, could these enthusiastic registered Democrats be potentially voting to recall the governor?
We don't expect that that's the case. The polling, I think, shows a real strong partisan split on this. And these are the numbers that I think the Democrats and the Newsom campaign would definitely want. I think these are probably better than they would have expected. But you're right. There's going to be some segment of these Democrats who vote for the recall. There's going to be some segment of those Republicans who vote against the recall. So it isn't purely a partisan split. But as far as demographics go and correlate to vote in this election, it is clearly the strongest one.
Well, Sean, in your recent reporting, I mean, you were able to get a more nuanced picture of Democrats by interviewing them and where they stand on Newsom, and even if they intend to vote.
Yeah, we went out a couple of weeks ago and talked to voters around the state. What we got was a sense that they were just beginning to pay attention to the race in a lot of places. Early on, the polls were showing that if among all voters, if the governor were to run, among all voters, the recall would fail. That the governor would beat back a recall easily among all voters. But when you looked at likely voters, the race narrowed considerably. What we found when we went out was that people didn't know much about the race, were undecided among Latino voters in particular, younger voters in particular were undecided. There were a certain number of Democrats we spoke to who felt that they were disappointed in the governor, that for a variety of reasons, or just didn't like him personally. But we also found, as Paul pointed out, really partisan responses on both sides. The Republican voters we spoke to kind of gave us the same set of talking points about why they were going to vote to recall. They cited unemployment fraud and homelessness and vaccine mandates and the same sort of list of grievances against the governor. And the Democrats we spoke to also had their talking points and knew them well, and called the recall a waste of money and felt that it was a Republican power grab. So it seemed that the race was beginning to sort of coalesce into a pretty polarized race, but that there was also a sense that folks were just beginning to tune in. Mm-hmm.
You also have a recent report that really narrowed in on the leading Republican challenger, Larry Elder. You know, when you were doing your research and reporting, what stood out to you?
it was amazing. I couldn't help but feel all roads lead to time is a flat circle and all roads lead to Los Angeles in the 1990s. Larry Elder has been around for a very long time. He came on to talk radio in Los Angeles in the aftermath of the LA riots and during the rise of Rush Limbaugh and the sort of the conservative talk radio. He was a protege of Dennis Prager, and his viewpoints are sort of libertarian, and they have been well known, at least in LA, for a long time, but he has a national audience now. He's syndicated in many markets. And they're very sort of cut and dried about, Trump Republican type talking points. Although Mr. Elder has distanced himself from President Trump, former President Trump. He has, kind of said, I'm not that guy. I vote for all Republicans anyway. And then, of course, he's walked that back some, too. So he's a somewhat unvetted candidate in some ways politically, but his viewpoints are very well known.
Well, the last question is going to go to both of you. I mean, there's been a series of debates this month. The latest was just last night, hosted by KCRA and the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm just curious if anything stands out to you with these debates, especially since last night, Democratic challenger Kevin Perfrath actually participated for the first time. Paul?
He definitely made a little mark by suggesting we should be getting our water from the Mississippi. Was that right?
Yeah, Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and that's a pretty, I don't know that who his political strategists are, but at least at the end of this thing, that he's the one we're talking about, and that's probably a win for him. He probably knows how to get attention as kind of a YouTube guy. What's interesting on the other side of the ballot, the replace ballot, there's a couple things that I think are really striking. One is that the Newsom campaign has been kind of handed a gift in the Larry Elder campaign. Democrats who maybe, 6 weeks ago were like, hey, that recall's silly, that's not a real deal. I don't really care about it. I'm not going to vote, like not really thinking about it. They were really, I think, you know, kind of kicked in the butts by the early polling that showed that this was close and that Newsom could lose and the recall could pass. And then also the realization that, wait, the top polling candidate on the replace side is this guy. And so whether it's progressives worried about, you know, core gun, environmental choice, those things have really resonated now that they have this candidate on the other side who, you know, would on day one probably try to put in appointees and veto laws and you know, change, use the executive orders to change a lot of what the administration's done on these key progressive issues. And the second thing I think that's striking about the replace side is that replace candidates have a much tougher campaign than the Newsom campaign. The Newsom campaign is basically a binary. You know, it's vote no on the recall and that's it. And they just can focus on that one single task. Now on the replace side, they have a responsibility to try to, you know, be in this multi-way, you know, multi-side war among themselves to try to figure out who can be the top vote getter. And then on the side, they're trying to push the yes. So it's kind of a war that is asymmetrical between the two sides. And it's a real advantage, I think, for the no to have an opportunity to have a cleaner message and one focus.
Sean, I mean, you've been a journalist focused on California for such a long time. I mean, has there been anything in this process, especially in the past, you know, month or so as we get closer to the recall, that has made you kind of go pause and go, huh, really?
This didn't become partisan sooner. You know, I was a little surprised that people were as tuned out as they seemed to be earlier on, just because there don't seem to be any local or statewide races anymore. They seem to mostly be national now. Politics seems to be mostly national now, and certainly the race in California races anyway tend to have a national aspect to them. So I was a little surprised that people were as tuned out as they were. I was amused and surprised by the entry of Larry Elder into the race. People didn't expect somebody with a higher media profile to be to enter the race. I mean, Caitlyn Jenner has a high profile, Larry Elder with all of his his 1990s viewpoints and 1990s references and female friends and ex-girlfriends who have had a profile in LA since the 1990s. I had to laugh. I just thought, wow, you know, the past isn't past. So,
yeah. Well, thank you both for joining us this morning. Paul Mitchell is with the bipartisan data firm Political Data Inc., and Sean Hubler is a California correspondent for the New York Times, updating us on the latest with the recall election that is fast approaching Tuesday, September 14th. Up next, as the Caldor fire threatens more homes and structures as it encroaches on the Lake Tahoe Basin, we sift through the uncomfortable and hazardous impact of air quality and its damage to the local community. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Caldor Fire in El Dorado County has grown to nearly 140,000 acres. The air quality in and around the region has been at dangerous levels for weeks. The smoke is just so thick and murky. Lake Tahoe is unrecognizable. No surprise that the Tahoe Basin is taking the undesirable top spot when it comes to the worst air quality readings this week. NBC News reported as of Wednesday, Lake Tahoe had the worst air quality in the world. As of this morning, the AQI, Air Quality Index, spanning North and South Lake Tahoe, hovers around 195, which is unhealthy, but it is a huge improvement from earlier this week. Joining us now to get a sense of where things stand with air quality and how to make sense of the alarming AQI numbers is the director of the Air Quality Research Center at UC Davis, Anthony Wexler. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, good morning.
You know, Anthony, first, just to get this out of the way, how exactly is air quality measured? Where do these numbers come from?
So the air quality index is primarily composed of the concentrations of two things in the atmosphere that are damaging to your health. One is PM2.5. That stands for a particulate matter less than 2.5 microns in diameter. So 2.5 microns is a very, very small amount. It's much less than the thickness of the hair on your head. But those are the particles that go deep into the lung and can trigger heart attacks and other health problems. The other part of the AQI, primary part of the AQI, is ozone, which is a gas. So there's particles in the atmosphere and there's gases in the atmosphere. And ozone also is pretty damaging to your lungs. And so there are regulations they're both state and federal regulations to control the concentration of those air pollutants in the atmosphere to keep them at levels that are low enough they don't harm your health.
Right. I was just astounded earlier this week that the air quality index, actually the AQI in the Tahoe area, like went above 500. I didn't even know if that was possible because I do check the AQI on a regular basis. I mean, is that unusual? Because isn't the limit like 500?
It's not unusual if you're in New Delhi or in Beijing.
Right.
But it's unusual in California, except when we have wildfires. Unfortunately, this may turn out to be a regular occurrence here every dry season here, every August, September, October. But yeah, the number doesn't have an upper limit. Mm-hmm. It can just keep up as the concentration of PM2.5 and ozone increases.
When it comes to an air quality index that is, you know, that high, I mean, even right now, the AQI is 195 in that area, which is still considered unhealthy. Should you even go outside? I mean, what can you do aside from, you know, wearing an N95 mask to protect yourself?
Yeah, so staying indoors is good. If you have or can get your hands on a HEPA filter, it's good to have that running in the room that you're in. If you can't stay indoors or if you don't have a HEPA filter indoors, it's a good idea to minimize the amount of work that you do, heavy work, so that you don't breathe more than you need to. Heavy labor, exercise, manual labor, those are going to cause you to breathe more, which means you'll have a larger exposure to the pollutants. And so to the extent that you can minimize that, that's going to be good for your health.
Yeah, and I think we're also learning how instrumental wind patterns and geography factor into AQI. I mean, I'll check at Placerville off Highway 50, and they have good air quality today. You know, 45-minute drive away, you're in South Lake Tahoe, and it's 195. If you can just explain, you know, how that topography and wind direction can really drastically impact the air quality from one area to the next.
Yeah, California has wonderful topography, which is one reason why some of us like to live here, to go skiing, say. But that also results in some serious air quality problems throughout much of the state. So Los Angeles has traditionally had the worst air quality in the country, and that's because it's a large urban area surrounded by mountains that trap the air. The San Joaquin Valley, similarly, you've got the Coast Range, you've got the Sierras, and you've got the San Bernardinos on the south, and it's a valley that traps the air. And so now Tahoe usually doesn't have a big sources of air pollution, and so the air is usually wonderful there. But with the wildfires, you have the mountains all around, rimming all around the lake, and so any air pollution that's in that basin is going to stay there until wind comes along and blows it away.
finally, I mean, just looking at the photos of Lake Tahoe, and we can end with this. I mean, it was just so staggering for me to see. You couldn't even see the lake. I mean, it was just like socked. And with your background as, you know, the director of the Air Quality Research Center, and this is your wheelhouse, was it surprising to you?
Well, a few years ago, I would have said yes. But now with basically the wildfire season, now we have something called a wildfire season. We've always had wildfires in California, but now it's just off the charts, and it's predictable that we're going to have terrible wildfire problems in the state this time of the year every year. And this is due to climate change, it's due to forest mismanagement, it's due to invasive species. There's a lot of different things. It's kind of a perfect storm of all three of these things coming together to cause these problems. And so I hope that we can do some things to reduce our climate problems and to manage our forests better, so that this is not going to go. So I hope that this won't go on forever, that we will have some solutions.
Anthony, thank you for helping us understand this a little bit better.
You're welcome.
Anthony Wexler is the director of the Air Quality Research Center at UC Davis. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. The hazardous air quality we just drilled into is heavily impacting the South Lake Tahoe area, resulting in the closure of schools, parks, and popular summer beaches. Carol Chaplin is the president and CEO of the Lake Tahoe Visitors Authority. She joins us now with a closer look. Welcome to Insight, Carol.
Good morning.
What does it look like out there today?
It's kind of a recurring pattern right now. The last couple of mornings, we've seen almost blue skies, which is very uplifting for those of us who live here and are used to those, you know, very blue skies. And then as the morning goes on, it tends to, you know, the winds tend to shift a little bit, and we start to see, you know, the visibility kind of close in on us. So that's where we are right now. It's a little bit cooler up here this week, which is good. With the warmer temperatures last week, you know, it was not only smoky, but it was also much warmer. So those of us who live in the mountains and like, you know, have those temperate temperatures in the summertime, we don't have air conditioning. So It's a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, earlier this week, you know, we were just saying that Lake Tahoe had the worst air quality in the world. I mean, it was over 600, the AQI. You actually are, and everyone in your community are living through it. How was that?
Well, not good. I mean, honestly, you know, for the residents of Lake Tahoe, and as well as all of our visitors, you know, the outdoor recreation and, you know, the beauty of the area is what we enjoy. And certainly for the LTVA, that's what we promote. And so for us to have this degradation of air quality and visibility is pretty tough. We're used to working outside, we're used to recreating outside, and of course, you know, the Forest Service has closed their lands for good reasons, and so, you know, it's quiet, and we're just hoping for the best for the firefighters this week as the weather kind of turns in their favor.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we've all kind of been accustomed to this unfortunate reality of hazardous air quality during wildfire season, which, you know, feels year-round. But from your recent memory, has the air quality in Lake Tahoe been this bad?
No, I mean, I've been here for a long time. You know, if I told you how long, you'd know exactly how old I was. But, you know, we've had three major, you know, fires in our region, as you know. You know, the Dixie has been burning for many weeks now. And, of course, the Tamarack fire down in the valley to our east burned for many days and is still kind of smoldering. And then, of course, the Calder fire has loomed up. So not only are we not used to having this kind of air quality right now, we are not used to having it, you know, loom over us for, you know, 30 or more days, I think is probably, yeah, you know, not an exaggeration. So I've never seen it this bad.
You know, historically, if I'm correct, I mean, kind of peak summer season starts, kicks off after Memorial Day, wraps up before Labor Day in the Lake Tahoe area. What are you hearing from your business community? I mean, we're still like 18 months and counting into this pandemic and, you know, just trying to get back on their feet financially.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't know that we've ever had this kind of, you know, sustained challenge. We live in the mountains, so we're used to a little bit of, you know, where Mother Nature is, you know, a challenge and a conversation every day. But you're right, the pandemic shut us down completely for several months. Then our businesses were open at limited capacity, and we're still, you know, we're still trying to get back, you know, back to normal, and now we're in this other unnormal. So it has been a struggle, and some businesses have obviously activities and Forest Service concessions have closed for the season. Visitors are either not coming or leaving early, and it could be a kind of slow shoulder season for us before we get to winter. All we can do is hope for early snow at this point.
Right. I mean, before the South Lake Tahoe area and just the Lake Tahoe Basin, before wildfires began impacting the community, how was the summer season?
It was incredible. As I mentioned earlier, the summer season, you know, we found, as other outdoor recreation areas have found, that people craved that after being shut in for so long, looking for a place to get out, to be with friends and family, still being probably a little bit conscious of distance and, you know, being out in the air. So we had a great summer, and we were looking forward to carrying that into the fall. You know, we thought that visitation would really remain stronger longer, and we're going to kind of pivot and see how we can mitigate, you know, some of the economic impacts to the area.
You were talking about a sustained impact and sustained challenges over, you know, what's going to be pushing up on 2 years. I guess when you're looking at the economic impact, what's your overarching concern for your area?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is that visitors who are not in the area are slower to understand when we are recovering, perhaps. So when we had the Angora fire here years ago, we heard from visitors, you know, I heard your beaches are black, and yet we're looking at, you know, wonderful skies, you know, beautiful water and everything else. And so, you know, there's a hangover when we have these catastrophic situations. So that, you know, that's one. We're going to have, as the LTVA, we're going to have our work cut out to us to show potential visitors that we have recovered and we're back and it's a good and fun place to experience. I mean, that's our number one goal, is to create an experience that people love and make memories around. The other one is that we have a lot of small businesses here, family-owned businesses, you know, businesses with less than 10, you know, employees or 20 employees. We don't have big box kind of situations, so they can't sustain this kind of financial hardship for long lengths of time. So that would be my other concern.
What is your message to visitors right now?
Well, our message is to, you know, to go to the sources that are available for them to make decisions about future travel. We have a lot of those resources right on our website, TahoeSouth.com, on our update page. And those will jump off to the City of South Lake Tahoe, Caltrans, which, you know, obviously has to do with road closures and road conditions, Forest Service, CAL FIRE. All of those resources are available on our website. We want them to determine for themselves what the best thing to do is. We are also available to, you know, talk in person, or if they've already made reservations, I would say that they might want to talk to the lodging property that they are planning to stay with and talk to them about conditions going forward. We're staying very close with our city officials to understand, you know, what the next steps are. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the next couple of days are supposed to be, you know, conditions are supposed to be better for our firefighters. We have 2,600 there now, as opposed to the 1,500 a couple weeks ago, and you know, crossing our fingers that that this gets that we, you know, get some containment on this thing, and that the weather changes.
Yeah, especially containment is now 12%. I believe yesterday or the day prior it was 5%. So that is an improvement. If people are thinking about heading up there this weekend, you know, Highway 50 is a main thoroughfare for emergency responders. I mean, would you recommend that they wait for another weekend, especially with the smoke and given the favorable weather conditions for firefighters?
I think that what I would say is that conditions are not optimum right now. So, you know, coming up here this weekend has a lot of challenges. As you've been talking in your program, we have visibility challenge. You know, we have visibility issues. We have air quality issues. We've got our main artery to the west is closed. There's a lot of things that are not optimum, and I'm not sure that the experience is what we would normally promote.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Carol, thank you for spending time with us. And I hope the air gets a lot better soon. And sorry for all the okay. struggles y'all are going through.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Carol Chaplin is the CEO of the Lake Tahoe Visitors Authority. Still ahead, we preview the film The Golden Bouzouki with deep roots in the 916 music scene, showing at the Crest Theater this weekend. And finally, we remember beloved orchestra conductor Michael Morgan, who passed away at the age of 63. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Been to the movies lately, or better yet, a B-film? This Saturday, there'll be a showing of The Golden Bouzouki at the Crest Theater with live music to wrap up the film. Set in ancient mythological Greece, the main character sets out in search of the Golden Bouzouki, a legendary musical instrument of divine origin, which is said to bring peace to the hearts of all mankind. Joining us now is the film's director, Joel Goulet. Joel, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm so pleased to be here. It's an honor to be on Capital Radio.
Well, I am excited to have you. Joel, do you consider this a B-movie?
Absolutely, or at least it aspires to be a B-movie. I think the original definition for B-movie was that it didn't contain any A-list Hollywood actors. And so this definitely falls into that category. But I think that construct is kind of ridiculous anyway, and these days B movies are a totally different animal.
Yeah, I watched your trailers and you could just see how much fun you all were having. I'm just so interested to learn that the film took 10 years to release. Just talk to us about that journey.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, so we started out with very little budget. So there's a lot of challenges that brings, which makes everything take a lot more time. Making movies a lot of work. And we have a very, very talented and very brilliant cast and crew, but there's still so much to do. And we decided to do it all ourselves, and most of the work fell upon me. So we wrote the film, directed it in 2011, filmed the actors and built all the sets. And then between 2011 and 2021, we've been building puppets and filming them for the creature effects and recording sound and overdubbing the dialogue so that it would sound like an Italian Hercules movie. And finally, finally adding music and putting the final finishing touches on and releasing it to the public.
Well, you took inspiration from older films like Jason and the Argonauts, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and Hercules in The Haunted World. You know, why a Greek epic Elvis musical?
Well, the Elvis musical came up because my dear friend Jay Baker was having a bachelor party, and rather than do all the traditional lame bachelor party stuff, he wanted to have an Elvis movie, make an Elvis movie. So we got a camera and got together in Grass Valley where I lived, and we made a movie called Bachelor Blues. And we enjoyed it so much, we also created a character named Johnny Diamonds to star in the movie. And we liked that so much, we made another one called Legend of the Snow Buddies in the snow. After that, that was so uncomfortable. We were so cold, our feet, that we really wanted to make the next movie at the beach. So we, that being the backdrop, it lends itself very well to a sand and sandal kind of movie, inspired by those Harryhausen movies you mentioned and some of those awful Hercules movies from the 60s. And
so bad they're good. They come
so bad they're good.
They
there's
circle.
so much good stuff in every bad movie. The things that make movies bad, it's hard to even define, right? But there's always so much good stuff, and I've been a lover of those movies for my whole life since I was a kid, pointing out errors in the special effects and laughing about it, and things like that are so fun to watch.
Well, we do have a clip of the trailer, so I want to take a listen to that, and we can chat about it after.
Sounds great.
These tiresome Greek heroes are ruining our political progress.
I'll stop their journey. Slow it down at every turn. Using every devious trick in the book. Brosiphus is dead.
Yeah.
Brosiphus is dead.
Looking out for him. I think I should be captain of the ship. What do you think, boys?
We can keep the people and the village of this city-state on their knees.
It is just so much fun to watch. And what's so cool about it is you filmed on the beaches on the Central Coast, you know, Santa Cruz and also in San Francisco. And there's also some shots in Sacramento or connection to Sacramento as well, correct?
Yeah, we filmed a few days in Sacramento, mostly in front of the green screen. Most of this movie was filmed in people's backyards. What wasn't done at the beach, we filmed in people's backyards. We actually built a full-size 25-foot Greek boat in my friend Hod's backyard in Santa Cruz. And then we bought this giant green screen to throw behind it and make it seem like there was water there. But in Sacramento, we did a very similar thing. We went to my friend's backyard and filmed a whole bunch of people standing doing cool stuff in front of the screen.
I think what's also so cool about this is after the film, because it's going to be playing at the Crest Theater this weekend, there's also going to be live music, right?
Indeed. The band that performs the music in the film, it is a musical, is going to be performing after the movie. And the star of the film, Johnny Diamonds, is going to appear on stage with the band for the first time in over a decade, which is pretty exciting.
Finally, what's so special about the cast and the crew? I mean, I know y'all are friends, and this is really like a decade-long journey that, you know, you're going to see come to fruition this weekend.
These people are true geniuses. I'm so lucky to have been working with them for so long. Some of these folks I've been making movies and music with for upwards of 30 years, and we've just stayed together and stayed friends and stayed collaborators for all this time and added more and more people as we go. In a way, it's interesting. It reminds me of the Muppet movie in real life, in that they just keep moving forward towards a goal and grabbing more friends and making the whole thing more special and more exciting.
Well, Joel Goulet, I apologize for mispronouncing your last name at the beginning, joins us with the B film, The Golden Bouzouki. I am so excited for you this weekend, Joel.
Boy, I am too. Thank you. It is, you may have mentioned it, but I'll throw it out again that it is August 28th at the Crest Theater, September 1st at Balboa in San Francisco, and also September 2nd at the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, and in the one at the Crest Theater this Saturday in Sacramento, we'll have live music to wrap up the film. So it's a lot of fun to spend your weekend.
Indeed.
We are listening to Insight here on CAMP Radio. Before we close, we're going to remember a Sacramento maestro who championed community and diversity in classical music. Michael Morgan, the longtime music director for the Sacramento Philharmonic and Oakland Symphony, strived to have his organizations better represent the communities they served. Morgan died last week from an infection following a kidney transplant. He was 63 years old. Morgan was appointed music director of the fledgling Sacramento Philharmonic Orchestra in 1999. He remained in that post until 2015, after which he would become the music director emeritus until his passing late last week. We went through the archives and found an interview with Michael Morgan on Insight back in 2005 with then-host Jeffrey Callison. As a conductor, Morgan believed the orchestra, especially smaller orchestras, should strive to represent the communities they served.
If you can manage somehow to make what you do reflect your community, it's going to be different than what the San Francisco Symphony does. We've done, for example, up here, we've done composers from both Sac State and from UC Davis on our various programs. And you really do shape the orchestra to fit its community.
As director, Michael Morgan was known for his wide-ranging, inclusive programming, making sure that symphonies are for everyone, welcoming notable personalities like comedian activist W. Kamau Bell and labor leader Dolores Huerta to curate playlists for the orchestra to play.
You have a lot of competing interests that you have to serve. There is the part of the audience that wants to hear the standard repertory, the Bach, the Beethoven, the Mozart, the Brahms, those people. Then there is a part of the audience that likes to hear something newer or more or different. I started to say different-er. new or different. So you have to satisfy them. And I have decided that the orchestra's part of the orchestra's mandate would be to play a California composer on every concert except the All Mozart concert each year, because as the orchestra of the state capitol, it seems to me the least we can do is to play a California composer on each concert.
Born in Washington, D.C., Michael Morgan began conducting at the young age of 12 years old, and those who worked closely with him remember his larger-than-life personality, his meticulous work ethic. Here's a glimpse of how he hoped to influence those around him.
One hopes some inspiration for the players, as well as being a unifying force for all the various constituencies that support an orchestra, the players, the public, the board, the union, everyone, just being a unifying force.
And during the performance?
During the performance, it's all about, still about being a unifying force, but it's being a unifying force for those players on the stage. And one hopes putting across a cohesive vision of the pieces that are being played for the audience, so that the audience has taken on that journey that one goes on when you give yourself over to a symphony orchestra concert. So the conductor also should inspire the audience. Not to mention, these days, I think the conductor should be approachable and should be able to talk to people about what the music is about.
And that was Michael Morgan, the longtime music director for the Sacramento Philharmonic and Oakland Symphony, speaking with then Insight host Jeffrey Callison back in 2005. Now, Morgan was actually set to receive the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Sacramento's Living Heritage Foundation, which recognizes arts and media professionals who specialize in presenting works by or about African Americans and women of note. The award was to be given at a concert in May of 2020, But as we all know and have lived through, that concert was canceled due to COVID-19 and will now be given posthumously at an Oakland Symphony concert in January of next year. Michael Morgan died last week from an infection following a kidney transplant. He was 63 years old. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. For our closed music today, you'll hear Sinfonietta for 11 Instruments from the San Francisco Conservatory of Music Faculty Artist Series Recital, performed on November 1st, 2015 at the Hume Concert Hall and conducted by Michael Morgan. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Thank you.